Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 21st, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Jim Flink. On our program this week, what's going on at the New York Times? Leadership changes, leaked memos, and more. An announcement that the Oprah Winfrey Network will air a documentary series centering on Michael Sam Summer trying to make the St. Louis Rams, followed by another the very next day, that project is being shelved. And the King of Pop appears on stage live at the Billboard Music Awards. Well, not exactly. We'll explain. There's a whole lot more that we're hoping to get to before our time's up today. But let's start with the big news of this week at the New York Times. It started last Wednesday, right about the time we were preparing last week's show. Publisher Arthur Sulzberger announced that executive editor Jill Abramson was out and that Dean Baquet would take over effective immediately. That news came as a shock to many in the Times newsroom and many more in our industry. Abramson, the first female to run that paper in its more than 160 years, had only been in the position for about 2.5 years. There have been many reports and rumors about what led to her ouster, and we'll get to some of those in a minute. But first, let's hear from Abramson herself, speaking to graduates at Wake Forest University's commencement on Monday.
You know, New York Times journalists risk their lives frequently to bring you the best news report in the world. That's why it is such an important and irreplaceable institution. And it was the honor of my life to lead the newsroom. A couple of students who I was talking to last night after I arrived, they know that I have some tattoos. And one of them asked me, are you going to get that Times T that you have tattooed on your back removed? Not a chance.
That may have been a brave face, or Abramson may be gearing up for a fight. See, that's because several of the reports out there indicate Sulzberger got rid of her because she complained she was being paid less than her predecessor, Bill Keller. Sulzberger issued a statement denying that and citing problems with her aggressive management style, something he didn't appreciate as much. Maybe you saw this cover of the New York Post featuring a photo of Abramson in the gym, decked out in boxing gloves, poised to take on a full-sized punching bag. That photo had originally been posted on Instagram by her daughter. There is so much going on here.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was watching the graduation speech, as a lot of other people were, too, wondering whether she was going to take the gloves off or not, and she didn't. I mean, I think she did the right thing in the way she handled that occasion. I don't know that that has any reflection at all on what she's going to do going forward or the issues that people have laid out as to why she was fired.
The New Yorker went into quite a bit of depth in two pieces that talked a little bit about maybe the inside story about why this is, and sort of pointed out the fact, like all good journalists, Jill Abramson was probably a little bit difficult to get along with at times, probably didn't answer to authority all that well. Some of the very same things that you look for in a good journalist are sometimes the things that maybe can run you afoul with management if you're a little too direct. And that seems to be the case here.
And that would have been an interesting enough story, as it were, to see whether or not being brusque and pushy, as some people described her, is okay for male executives but not okay for female executives. Would have made for a great story if it had just stopped right there. But then Ken Auletta from The New Yorker, yes, and David Folkenflik from NPR were both reporting that also she was fired for having the temerity to raise the question about her not being paid as much as her predecessor as executive editor. And that really pushed the pedal down when it came to social media and other people covering the story.
Not only did she challenge the ownership of the Times on that issue, but that she also apparently hired an attorney to take it one step further and to find out once and for all perhaps whether the fact was true. And this is an industry problem. It continues to be an industry problem where women oftentimes don't get paid as much as men. It's one of those things that in lots of contracts, I had a contract that I was sworn to secrecy on for years in television. And so you don't really know until somehow you might find out. And by then, usually it does kind of put you in that situation.
I don't know that we will ever find out. We probably will not find out for sure exactly what Jill Abramson's compensation package was, not just her salary, but stock options and all that stuff, and whether or not she was making less. But it really doesn't matter at this point because, frankly, the Times and Arthur Sulzberg, they lost that spin war. I mean, the meme that's out there right now on almost every news story, except for a few more nuanced pieces in print, and on every social media post is all about how she was fired because she dared to raise questions about salary.
So let me ask you, was that fair? So these pieces in The New Yorker, the Ken Oyelato piece, the Folk and Flick piece, have we gone deep enough to try and get both sides of that story to try and flesh it out? Or have we just so tightly hung on to that narrative of the equal pay, of the attitude and brusque nature and male-female that we've just hung on to it and that's what is going to last?
Well, I mean, I will say that there's been plenty of coverage when Sulzberger came out and denied that it was about money and gave more detail about why she was fired and said that, in fact, that her pay isn't the only, you know, the salary wasn't the only part of her compensation. That was reported. But even when you saw those stories being reported, you still see the headlines. You still see the graphics at the lower third graphics and television coverage. They oversimplify it or boil it down to fired because of salary question mark. And that's as far as a lot of people get with it.
And that's where the narrative is now. And I think the narrative could evolve, especially as we find out more about the leaked memo that you mentioned off the top of the show that I know we'll get into where the narrative could turn. But Mike's right. Where it is right now is very solidly that they're losing that spin war.
So another piece of this story that has also been lost in a lot of this is the elevation of Dean Baquet as the new executive editor at the New York Times. And just as Abramson was the first female executive editor, Baquet is the first African-American executive editor. In a different situation, under different circumstances, that would be the story here.
That'd be a big story. And I think eventually there will be plenty written about his elevation to the Times, especially if he manages to calm the waters and continues to win awards and all of that. But I will say that he's also a player in this whole business about Abramson getting fired. And if you look at some of the stories, they reported that perhaps the real reason or one of the biggest pushes that led to him, her being fired was the fact that she tried to bring on an editor for digital, somebody she knew, a female editor from The Guardian, and apparently didn't tell Baquet that she was going to be doing this in advance. He, if you believe some of the reports, threatened to walk if something wasn't done about that. So if you're Sulzberger, you're left with, do I choose between the first female editor, whom I don't get along with, the first African-American editor?
Who do I do?
Yeah, who I do. Then what?
Yeah, and this becomes a he says, she says, where I'm not sure anybody really wins. A lot of reputations are sullied in as much as all of us are paying attention to it.
Well, we've spent a lot of time on this story today. And before we move on, I want to bring up the reaction of one journalist, one of the most well-known voices on public radio, Ira Glass. Monday, a reporter from New Yorker magazine asked Glass for his reaction to Abramson's firing while he was at the Peabody Awards in Athens, Georgia. His response? Jill who? You can read the full interview, the full Q&A underneath the programs tab on our links blog at kbia.org. And I hope people check it out because it raises a good point. Do people outside of our little echo chamber even care about this?
Well, you know, in this particular instance, I think they should. I get it that sometimes there's just too much navel-gazing. The media think that they're more important than they really are. But this is a story about sexism in the news business. And, I mean, you don't have to agree that that's why she was fired, but it raises some really interesting questions. And you have a link on our blog to a study that was released recently that shows that it's still a big problem.
And we've talked about it. here in the past few weeks.
On the other hand, I don't have a problem. I mean, I think it's kind of refreshing in a way, right, that Ira Glass can say, I was too busy working on my own stuff. I don't pay attention to that.
Sometimes in our own bubble, we do overdo the importance of who we are as opposed to what it is that we're doing. I think he's just shining a light on the fact that once the lights go down.
Although I thought that Odd Gawker was really interesting because when they ran the story, their comments section was pretty hilarious. There was one person in there who goes by Bed and Breakfast Man who had a really interesting parody of Ira Glass in This American Life. Today's theme, washing dishes. Three stories about washing dishes. Why do we wash dishes? What compels some people to wash dishes right away while others can wait hours, sometimes even days? That was a pretty hilarious and straight-on parody of This American Life.
Some of those comments are great. I like the one that you pulled there. Some of them have some language that's a little too colorful for us to be talking about here on KBIA, but do check that out. Ira Glass says he reads the New York Times and thinks the folks there do a bang-up job. But a 96-page internal document linked to BuzzFeed reveals there's some dissatisfaction with its digital products. What's in this report?
Well, basically something that I think we all have a pretty good sense of, and that is that major media organizations, legacy media organizations, are not keeping up with some of the newer players. I mean, if you want to just do a big blanket statement about it, it's that. It's that as much as anyone within those organizations may think that they're making significant changes and the Times has invested quite a bit in it, the fact of the matter is most of them aren't keeping up with the pace of change.
And I think a couple of specifics are pretty interesting to look at just for a second or two. Mm-hmm. So those top editors at the New York Times, for example, several of them admitted they're not familiar with digital content. They're not familiar with the analytics that are used to measure the success of digital content and to act on it. You also had a lot of folks saying, you know, hey, we're losing ground because now – places that we never thought we were competing with, the Huffington Post or Vox or Yahoo. BuzzFeed, they're hiring more reporters and editors. And so they're starting to eat into that the actual journalistic core that's the advantage for the New York Times.
At the same time, though, we're talking about the same news organization that built Snowfall, that changed the way we're doing long-form journalism online. Are they really as behind as this report leads to believe?
Well, the problem with Snowfall is that it's one big play. And who knows how many resources were put into creating Snowfall in order to get that big play. And yes, we all still talk about it. But the thing about it is that what's really resonating in the marketplace is folks who innovate on a day-to-day basis and who bring us maybe not this big Snowfall play, but they're bringing us innovation in ways that change the way we consume media.
And the Times has a conundrum to deal with. I mean, more of their readers now are coming to digital editions than the print edition, which is not something that every newspaper can say. But still, like most newspapers, most of their revenue is coming from the print edition because the costs or that they can charge for print advertising higher than what they can charge for online advertising.
And let's not forget to mention, as we have previously on this show, that a lot of the most innovative journalists are jumping ship from the Wall Street Journals and the New York Times of the world to go to the Voxes of the world and to other organizations. They're starting
Yahoo,
Recode or
yes.
whatever it might be in order to get and stay on the edge of what's happening.
Okay, well, there is other media news to talk about this week, including some stories of local interest to us here in mid-Missouri. At about dinner time last night, a federal appeals court stayed the execution of Russell Bucklew. He was set to be the seventh Missouri prisoner executed since November and the first since the botched execution in Oklahoma 2 weeks ago. At the time that we're recording today's program, we're still waiting to hear if that execution will take place today as scheduled. Right now, it's in the hands, as we're recording this, in the hands of the United States Supreme Court. At the time we talked about the Oklahoma execution, we talked about what changes we might expect to see in the news coverage here right now today with the scheduled execution. And there have been a few. Among them, two lawsuits filed by news organizations, including the Associated Press, St. Louis Public Radio, and the Kansas City Star, claiming that the secretive way that the state of Missouri obtains lethal injection drugs prohibit public oversight of the death penalty. It's an interesting approach to keeping executions public, to keeping that transparency alive.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there is more of a history of trying to lock down transparency than there is to creating greater transparency in what is a fairly significant social issue that we should all continue to discuss. And that is that whenever there has been sort of a flaw pointed out in the system, rather than addressing the flaw in a very transparent way, the state of Missouri in a couple cases has decided to lock down more information, that is to say, not make it so transparent. And that's a problem.
And it's not just unique to Missouri. We've seen that with the federal government. We've seen that with other governments as well.
No, lots of states do that. And in fact, the Department of Corrections has tried to maintain that the reason they don't release information in this particular instance with the lawsuit from the Associated Press and others about the people who manufacture the drugs, what the drugs are, how the drugs are tested for efficacy and safety and all that, is because the drug makers are part of the execution team. And under Missouri law, you're not allowed to release the names of the execution team. Now, that's stretching logic quite a bit. I understand why you wouldn't want to name the person who, you know, injects the drugs or who, you know, started the electric chair or fired the shot or whatever it might be, because you don't want to open them up to criticism or harm. But I don't see how any of that applies to the drug companies.
Do you think this lawsuit's going to ultimately bring any change?
I don't necessarily think it will. I mean, we've got a couple of precedent-setting cases that say that the Department of Corrections can lock down information and availability of information to inmates as long as they have a greater good, that is, the safety of the institution and the guards.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. There was another issue very closely related to this that came up this week. The Missouri Department of Corrections has banned the May issue of St. Louis Magazine over an article entitled How We Kill. William Powell's feature detailed the final hours of Herbert Smulis leading up to his January 28th execution. What is the department's justification for doing that?
Well, they say that it could lead to fostering hatred or violence within the prison system. And I have to say, I can understand that argument. I truly can. On the other hand, I've read the article. You've got it posted
on
our blog.
Links blog.
And it's a very comprehensive magazine piece. It takes you all – I mean, it gives you all sides of the issue. The author, William Powell, does come down on this notion that the process is too secretive. Mm-hmm. But it seems like it's a pretty fair article. On the other hand, I can imagine that you might not want, if you're running, you know, the correction system or the state prisons, that you might not want that article being seen by a lot of inmates who could cause problems.
Yeah, and those two cases, Turner versus Safely in 1987, Beard versus Banks in 2006. You know, in both cases, it's about trying to keep control of the prison population. This coverage could theoretically, I suppose, incite a discussion or worse inside of the prison walls about what's going on with the executions.
So there has been an appeal made to the Department of Corrections. It's probably not likely to be lifted, this ban. About a year ago, we talked about a Minnesota prison that was banning certain reading materials. Apparently, it is a legal thing to do. But as journalists, should we be fighting that kind of censorship, or should we be okay with it?
Well, you know, I think transparency is what we want. And so in that respect, and I think even the St. Louis magazine correctly notes, look, we understand and support the idea of keeping inside the walls of the prison a safe place. That goes without. But be more transparent in other areas so that this doesn't become one more thing that says you're not being transparent.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, freedom of expression is one very important value that we hold. But I think safety inside the prison system is also a value that's worth upholding as long as the prison system is calibrated about how it can be transparent in one area and maybe not so much in another area.
Last week on this program, we talked a lot about Michael Sam. Well, we're going to do it again, because no more than an hour after we talked about his commitment to surviving the preseason and making the team, leaving the media circus of his draft behind, there was word from the OWN network that he would be the star of a documentary television series. Here's his agent, Cameron Weiss, talking on ESPN Radio's Mike and Mike in the Morning.
We're talking about, you know, capturing just Mike's personal reactions and mainly not even on his training days, on his off days away from the team, things that give us insight into his private and personal life and into his journey and what's going on inside of his head.
Is this something that Michael was all for when presented to him, or were there reservations about this is going to be training camp and I need to concentrate on football?
you know, there's always pros and cons when you're talking about a decision like this, but I think, you know, we know the magnitude of the journey. Mike's number one goal, of course, is to make the roster, and the team we put in place is absolutely going to respect that, and we're not going to try and put anything additional on his plate if we see that there's stress or anything like that. Of course, there's always going to be situations, you know, where a guy needs extra rest, the guy's tired, he needs to get, you know, PT, whatever it is, and, you know, we're completely going to be respectful of that. We've been assured there will be respect of that on the own side, and no one is going to complicate this journey for Mike, if at all possible.
That was Thursday. By Friday night, the OWN Network announced that it was postponing the series. Part of that decision was a discussion with the St. Louis Rams. Apparently, plans for this program were put in place without the knowledge of the team or the NFL.
Well, it's interesting because there are some reports that suggest, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch had one, saying that the NFL knew about it ahead of time but didn't bother to tell the teams. It's unclear whether they deny it. It's unclear whether that's true. It's apparently true that the Rams did not know, and that's one of the things that – you know, kind of just upset me as a viewer of this whole thing, was it may be true that Michael Sam is all about making the team, but the impression that story left was that he's about a lot of other things, including cashing in on his notoriety.
What I would say, speaking of cashing in, is that it's very interesting to me that the NFL I'm not sure if they didn't see the opportunity first or if they just didn't get to the opportunity first. The NFL, you know, I covered the Chiefs for 15 years, and when I first got to Kansas City, they allowed us free run down on the sidelines. We could go where, about year five in, man, it started to lock down more and more. The NFL is about controlling its brand, as is Major League Baseball, as is the NBA, and the fact that they didn't see the opportunity to create just this kind of documentary within their own walls, and that OWN jumped in on that and got ahead of them, I think that was a pretty big deal.
Well, and the NFL is among the most strict of each of those leagues that you had mentioned. During games, news organizations are only allowed to post so many photos, et cetera. What's interesting, though, is there are other documentary series. There's one on HBO. There's one on ESPN. How big of a distraction could this have been? I mean, it doesn't seem like one if there are these other shows out there.
I mean, my guess is that you had two competing interests here. You had the Rams' interest in not having a circus made of their training camp and getting ready for a season where they have drafted enough players that they might actually be pretty decent this coming season, versus the NFL and their brand identity. As Jim said, if the NFL had thought of it first – and had worked it out or forced it quietly upon the Rams, it would have happened. But because it was Oprah's network and none of that had happened, I think that's why we saw it get it canceled.
How big a distraction, as equally as big as an opportunity it is for whatever you might want to say about what this story can become for the NFL, for Michael Sam, for the St. Louis Rams. It is huge. It is huge on any – but – I think the key is, especially when you come to the dollars and cents of all of it, is everybody being on the same page and managing whatever that message is. Otherwise, it's a huge distraction.
Okay. Well, this week marked the 60th anniversary of the Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the Supreme Court decision that desegregated American schools. To mark the occasion, First Lady Michelle Obama challenged Topeka's class of 2014 to break through prejudices. Here is some of the coverage that aired on CBS affiliate WIBW.
Brown is still being decided every single day, not just in our courts and schools, but in how we live our lives.
The First Lady then challenged the graduates to be the force that brings the Brown case into the future by changing those prejudices.
So the answers to many of our challenges today can't necessarily be found in our laws. These changes also need to take place in our hearts and in our minds.
Some of the stories that came out in this past week show that there's actually more segregation than ever before in our schools, but it's a different type.
Yeah, it's really complicated because in some ways there is still segregation, especially along the lines of income, which also encompasses a lot of African Americans in this country. And so that's still a real negative kind of segregation in terms of educational opportunity. But as some of the coverage pointed out, there's also some voluntary segregation. There was a story out of Cleveland, I believe it was, saying that among the charter schools there, these schools set up to really, you know, compete against the public school model, are overwhelmingly African-American in their makeup. So it is a complicated story. One of the things I also thought that was really interesting, though, Amy, was how depressingly similar some of the arguments are in terms of the criticism that Michelle Obama came under when she was getting ready to make this speech. She was going to speak at graduation. And then the decision was made because apparently some parents complained. They complained, first of all, maybe legitimate, is this going to crowd out, you know, space for the relatives with all the Secret Service and all the media and all that stuff? But there were other people who said, we don't want her politicizing our graduation ceremony. Have we really come that far where the First Lady can't come and talk in a historic moment in the city where the decision came down and have a conversation with students and parents about this?
Well, and part of the problem with that thinking is to think that somehow 60 years ago something changed, you know, so markedly by a decision that was made in the courts that it was a point on a continuum rather than the evolution of the racial discussion in this country, which is more like a pendulum than it is a continuum. And it's a discussion that needs to continue. As to the point of voluntary segregation, you know, it is one of those things where, you know, and not to reference Kansas City again, but it's the place that I called home for so long. There are streets that are demarcation lines of segregation in Kansas City.
And that's not unique to Kansas City, where I grew up in Chicago, very much the same way. Suburbs within the city itself, there are just certain streets you don't cross because that's
right. And not to oversimplify it, but there is a lot of that is choice. No matter whatever efforts were made to bus school kids across cities and that kind of thing, you know, 30, 35 years ago, the fact of the matter is that people still want their kids to go to schools in their neighborhoods, to know folks who are a little bit like them usually, and those kinds of things tend to create those kinds of situations.
Well, finally, before we go today, a performance on Sunday night's Billboard Music Awards, some are calling pretty cool. Others are calling it pretty creepy. Michael Jackson, back on stage, performing a song from his second posthumous album, released last week.
MJ alongside 16 live dancers on stage and in the aisles, twisting, and of course, moonwalking, moving some to tears and bringing the crowd to its feet. Jackson's brother Jackie, the only member of the Jackson family in the audience.
It's like he was right here with us. I got teary-eyed a little bit just to see my brother up there. I thought he was there for real.
Might be a little bit of a stretch. I thought he was there for real.
Yeah.
Where do you guys come down on it? Creepy or cool?
Go ahead.
Oh, it was a technical tour de force, and I loved it. It was. You remember a few years ago when CNN had the hologram in the newsroom on election night? Yeah. It was so cheesy. This really looked real, and it was emotionally engaging. I'm just amazed that we have the technology that we can do it, and I imagine this isn't the last time we're going to see it applied.
That was going to be exactly my point. Not only is it cool, but I have a feeling it is a trend for the future that you're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing where somebody who's irreplaceable either in an industry or in your life, that you will be able to sort of dial them up and dial them in a hologram and be able to have some sort of limited interaction with them.
I saw the guy that run the company that did it, and he said that really it was Michael Jackson's head that they had, you know, taped for a variety of different angles on the body of another dancer that they got to do it. So it wasn't actually Michael Jackson dancing that they presented as a hologram.
Well, I don't know that it was going to be anyway.
No, but it wasn't all Michael Jackson recorded.
Mike, do we need to have a talk about how these things work?
I did love I would even say this much, the music. Yeah. Might not have been Michael Jackson's best album, his posthumous one, but it was a pretty darn good one for anybody alive today.
And everybody that was in the audience seemed to love it. So, you know, it's that show business, right?
Well, I guess it is. We're just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending this last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Do that by checking out our links blog. You can find that under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and to listen to our program again. Leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and a whole lot more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.